hit the brakes. Welcome to Swerve South.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of Swerve South. I'm Jamie Harker. I'm the director of the Sarah Eisen Center for Women and Gender Studies. And I'm here with our new friend, Baker Rogers, who's an assistant professor of sociology at Georgia Southern University. Baker, welcome to Swerve South.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We are so glad to have you here. So Baker is here to speak at our new Trans Summit this afternoon. But while he's here, we thought, let's get a little information about the work that Baker's doing. So if you don't mind, just to get started, Baker, can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you got interested in sociology as a field?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in rural South Carolina. Lancaster, South Carolina is the city I grew up in. And I really didn't know anything about sociology at first. I went to Presbyterian College for undergrad, and I just kind of the liberal arts education was a good fit for me because I could take all the classes, and that's how I found sociology, and I fell in love immediately, and I realized that I could use sociology to study my experiences in the rural South and with religion and gender and sexuality, and so that's kind of been not a straight path to where I am now, but my path started there with the sociology class at Presbyterian College, and now here I am.
That's excellent. Do you mind talking a little bit about your experiences growing up in the South in terms of gender, sexuality?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I grew up in, like I said, a really rural area, very conservative, both politically and religiously. We weren't evangelical Christians, but I feel like a lot of times mainline Christians in the rural South, they're pretty close, closely related. So very homophobic and transphobic environment, really. I don't even know if transphobic is the right word because we didn't even talk about it. So I didn't even hear it, didn't even know it existed. But homophobic for sure. And so it wasn't until I went to college and came out as a lesbian my first year in undergrad, and then started exploring gender and sexuality through sociology, through my different types of courses, coursework, and then eventually came out later on as genderqueer. But that was a long path and a hard path, and luckily my family has become accepting, but it took many, many years, so I guess I came out the first time. You know, you never just get to come out one time. It's a continuous process, but I came out the first time in 2003, and I would say it's only been in the last 5 years that I feel comfortable and like my family's fully accepting. And I have some books coming out, and in those I write about my family and things that we've never talked about. So I'm interested to see how that's going to go with my family dynamic soon as well.
Absolutely. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Did it help? Was your college a good place to do that, or was it sort of mixed, I guess I wonder?
Yeah. No, I would say it was a pretty bad place to do that back in 2003. I hope that that it's a better place now for that. But as luck would have it, or fate would have it, I was roomed with a person who identified as a lesbian. So I didn't really know anything about it, and I was very homophobic because I guess I kind of always knew something was different, but I didn't know what that was, and it was very scary. So just by learning about sexuality in class, and then through my roommate, who ended up being my first girlfriend, but I would say it wasn't a great place to come out. I started playing lacrosse. We got a team. I'd never seen lacrosse in my life because I'm from the rural South. And we got a team my sophomore year, and I wanted to be back in sports and have some kind of community because I didn't feel like I fit in at Presbyterian. And through that, I found some people that were supportive, or at least trying to be supportive and trying to learn. So that's how I kind of found community. But it was a rough start to coming out. But now I guess I wouldn't have it any other way. It's made me who I am, but it wasn't easy.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I grew up in a devout Mormon family, and I went to Brigham Young University.
Oh.
That was also, you know, not a good place to do that.
Yeah.
Though I met really good friends there who were also going through it that I've kept. So it sometimes that kind of pressure can let you build relationships that you wouldn't maybe have otherwise.
True, definitely.
We'll have to go there. I can't imagine, when people ask me, I think, I can't imagine it not being that. It's like saying you don't have the same parents you had, or it's so much part of the world you are. I can't imagine not having come from that.
Oh, yeah, so definitely. Just something interesting. I just got an email on my way here from Presbyterian because I guess it was 2015, I legally changed my name. And so I'm trying to update all my degrees. And so I emailed Presbyterian College and asked for a new degree with my new legal name on it. And I got an email from the assistant to the registrar that said, we don't change names on degrees. You can, we can send you a new one if you want, but we won't change your name on it. So I responded and said, well, that's unacceptable. And immediately the registrar emailed me back and said that they didn't have a policy in place and now they're working on it. And I got a follow up this morning saying they're writing the new policy and they would be in touch soon to send me a new degree. So Presbyterian is trying to move forward, but apparently I'm the first person who identifies under the trans umbrella who has asked for a new degree at Presbyterian College. So that was interesting to get on the way here.
Absolutely. Baby steps, which I think is really relevant to our conversation today, right? Uh-huh. Do you mind telling us a little bit about some of the books you have coming out?
Yeah, sure. Well, my first book, based on my dissertation research that I completed at Mississippi State. I know, Mississippi State, yeah.
We're good.
Okay. was about Mississippi Christians' views of homosexuality, and I use that term because that's the term they use, not the term I use, and gay and lesbian civil rights. So that book is titled Conditionally Accepted, Christians' Views on Sexuality and Gay and Lesbian Civil Rights, and it'll be coming out, I think it's December 13th, so about a month away.
That's exciting.
Yeah, with
Rutgers.
Thank you.
Is that the one you talk about your parents in as well?
Yeah, I really talk about them in both, so this one's more about sexuality and religion, and my second book is coming out in January. It's called Trans Men in the South, Becoming Men, Trans in the South, Becoming Men, and it's about interviews with 51 trans men across the region and their experiences. So I talk more about my gender identity in that book. And so my family has finally come to terms with me identifying as lesbian, but I haven't really come out to my family as genderqueer because it wouldn't even make sense to them, and it's really just seemed like irrelevant. So if they're going to call me by my correct name, which they're trying to do, and they're going to accept me and my family and my wife and my child, then I just didn't want to deal with it. But I do talk about it in the book, so we'll see if they actually read it closely.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I know trying to distill down now two books in a row, you're really overachieving. We didn't put that out there, but it's hard to distill a whole book into a couple of sentences. But would you mind just talking a little bit in either book or both, if you like?
Yeah.
What are some of the things you found? What are some of the insights you have from that?
The Mississippi Christians book, I think the main thing, and I started kind of looking at sexuality and religion in undergrad that's really got me excited about sociology. And I think I found the same thing in South Carolina that I find in Mississippi, and I think we'd find across the Southeast, is that it's way more diverse than people paint us out to be, right? So this idea that the South is wholly conservative and wholly closed-minded is just not true. And anybody that sat down and thought should be able to figure that out. But that's the media and society has decided this to write off the South. And I think that's why all my research has a Southern focus. Because writing off the South writes out a lot of people and it leaves a lot of us without resources. So that's kind of my argument, is that the South is more diverse than we think. That coming out is not going to work for evangelical Christians, probably. Like, it's just not the fix-all that we've been told has been. I actually last month spoke at Mississippi State for National Coming Out Day, and I was like, are you sure you want me to talk about this? Because my whole argument is that maybe National Coming Out Day has took us as far as we can go. And I think it was super important, and it still is important for our own personal well-being to be, if we feel safe to come out. But I think we might have gone as far as we can go. So I think that telling people to come out at this point when they're not safe, or when people aren't going to change their views. Evangelical Protestants I spoke to had children who were gay, niece, nephews, cousins, parents, and they still would never change their views. So it's like, we're just putting people in danger at this point, and making people feel maybe bad about themselves for not coming out. So I think we might have taken that narrative. Most people today know someone who's gay or lesbian already. If it hasn't changed their views, probably everybody keep coming out is not going to necessarily change their views. So that's kind of an argument that I haven't gotten to.
That is so interesting. I want to hear more about the rest of it, but can we pause there for a minute?
Yeah.
Because that's something we've been talking about here a little bit. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not as schooled in this as you and Amy are, and Amy McDowell, who's another one of our friends, but I'd love to hear about this. Yeah. But that question of the paradigm is, if you know someone who's gay, it makes you more accepting. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying, I've seen in other studies, which is that doesn't work when people perceive acceptance of LGBTQ people as being somehow counter to their faith.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, so what's the next step? If it's not coming out, and I agree with you, in a place that doesn't have legal protection for housing and employment, that narrative may not work. Is it about talking about diversity within theological systems? Is that the place to talk about it? Is it talk about it from other kinds of social service? It's like, you can believe what you want, but we need to give people opportunities to thrive. I'm just wondering, given that fact, which I think is, I've seen in other places, what do you do? What is the strategy?
Yeah, and I think, just to be clear, coming out does still work with the mainline Christians and a lot of the more liberal Catholics. So I think that if they don't know someone, coming out might work. But with evangelical Protestants, I honestly don't know, because the way I kind of frame it is, if their religious identity is more important than their all other identities, then they're going to hold that up, even if, some of these people's religious identities are even more salient than their identity as a mother, right? God comes first, and then I'm a mother. So I don't know how we change that. And when I spoke for National Coming Out Day, I told the students that was their job to figure out the next step. But I do think that, I'm trying to think, Arlie Hochschild's recent book about strangers in their own land, about conservatives in Louisiana. And she talks about, and I conclude the book a lot with empathy. And I think that we, as more liberal people, as queer people, we have to, when we're safe, when we're comfortable with ourselves, not when we're first coming out and trying to figure out ourselves, we have to listen to what they're arguing, because there's been this like, well, we don't even want to hear it. And they don't want to hear us, and so we can't figure out what that next step is. So I think there needs to be more empathy and listening, and how we do that, I'm not sure. And I don't know. I always say, I hope that I'm not as pessimistic as one of my respondents, who was a Methodist, United Methodist pastor, who said we just need to wait for some old people to die. And I want to say that there's other options, but I haven't figured out what they are yet.
I'm laughing. Like, for 50 years, I think we've been saying that, which is maybe not the best bet.
Yeah.
Remind me later to talk to you about this. I've been doing this podcast with a Southern Baptist preacher in Oxford, who reached out to me about a year and a half ago, because he heard about a Violet Valley bookstore, which I run in Water Valley. And he felt like he didn't like how separated the community was, and he wanted to have conversations. Mm-hmm. And we've been meeting and talking, and we started this podcast over the summer, where we basically talk about different views, and we listen to each other, and we don't necessarily always agree, but we know how to have conversations. Yeah. I don't know if it's leading anywhere, but it's been really fun, and we are friends, and we talk about things, and sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't, but we always are trying to understand perspectives. So that kind of engagement may be part of where we need to go in more structured ways. So.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like everything, politics, religion, everything in this country has become so polarized. And I know we talk about that all the time, but I think it's so true. We're not even listening, because there's probably things we agree on all these issues. I mean, I know that the mother that I spoke with, who still believes homosexuality is a sin, loved her son and wanted the best for him. So, like you said, if we talk about like what this looks like for his protection and for his rights, she would probably be on board for that. But first, we got to get at the table and listening to the same language.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's for him. I really respect that. This is, his name is J.D. Shaw, that he reached out of his comfort zone. I mean, I grew up in a conservative family, and I've lived in Mississippi for 17 years. So I know people from a variety of spaces, but he didn't really. And so he just sent a letter, and it was really impressive to see. So I'm interested to see where that will lead.
Real quick. At my talk at Mississippi State for National Coming Out Day, I found out afterwards, which I'm glad I didn't know before, because it might have made me a little worried, but there was a pastor in the room, apparently, who was a very strong proponent of conversion therapy for gay and lesbian people. And I'm not sure why he came or what he wanted to learn, but he didn't speak to me. I didn't know, but other people knew him from other things that had happened around the Pride event in Mississippi, at Mississippi State. So I thought that was interesting that he was there. And there was also a group of young white men from a very conservative group on campus. I can't remember the name of it, some Freedom for Young Americans.
Yes.
Yes. And some of them emailed me after. Some of them talked to me about how they really were trying to listen and learn, and trying to, the way they're doing some of the things on campus that I've heard about, I clearly do not support. But they were there trying to learn and saying that they wanted the same thing. They wanted a conversation. They wanted to learn without being shut down. And I think that this is a problem that we're shutting down conservative voices. Sometimes we don't want them to harm people. And so it's scary to have these conversations. But with people that are comfortable enough, like, we need to have these conversations with them, not young people who are trying to figure out their own identity, but those of us who are comfortable enough to have these conversations and disagree need to be having them.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's what university is for. I mean, when I think about the person I was at 18, and the kinds of conversation that I needed to have to think things through, if someone had come right at me, you know, and said, you're wrong and you're this and you're that, I think it would have shut me down.
Oh, definitely.
And I'm really grateful that I was in an honors program that encouraged the questioning and thinking and didn't keep you within orthodox bounds. And I think that's true for all of us. You know, we need to be personally safe and not bullied, but intellectually, I think we need to be challenged all the time.
Yeah, it's funny. We were actually talking last night at dinner about the book, and I haven't read it, The Coddling of the American Mind. And I haven't read it, but I hear there's a lot of talk about it and this idea of, like, people expecting to feel safe all the time, but can you actually learn if you're safe all the time? But we do have to be safe enough that we feel comfortable. So where do we draw this balance? Where do we find this balance in the classroom of making sure our students are safe and comfortable, but also challenging them to think outside of what they know, because that's always going to be uncomfortable.
Right. I think we need to be safe physically and threatened intellectually.
Yeah,
I think that's
all of us for different reasons.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting conversation. I'd love to see more kinds of encounters. I remember when I was at BYU, I was a member of the only feminist group they'd ever had, obviously.
Yeah.
And this conservative group, I knew it was a brother, someone I'd been a missionary in Japan, invited me to come talk to them. And I went, and I gave a little overview, and then they asked questions. And we didn't always agree, but we had a real conversation about views. And I'd love to see more of that. So I'd love to go and talk to these groups and say, what are your questions and where are we, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
This question of, like, you know, personal liberty and freedom suggests you don't want any kind of government intrusion into your identity. I think there's lots of ways you could agree on that.
I
totally agree. So if you don't mind, I'd love to hear more about your interviews with trans men and what did you learn about the trans community in the South from that project?
I think that I learned that things are still pretty rough in the South in some ways, but again, we can't say, like, the South is not a place for trans men. So some other research, specifically thinking about Emily Kajak's work, is called Midwest or Lesbian, right? So this idea that queer people live among us everywhere. Interestingly, this is a little off topic, but I got a review back from a paper about trans men in the South recently when I submitted an article to be published in a journal, and I got a review back that said, well, you need to do more to tell me why trans men live there. And I responded to this review, no, I will not do that, because trans men live there because that's where they live.
Trans men live everywhere.
Yes, trans men live everywhere. And trans men live there because they were born there, because they work there, because their family's there, because they like the rule, because their country, because they want to live there. So I think one of the purposes of this book was just to show there's a variety and diverse group of trans men who live here. And they are dealing with a lot of things where resources lack. And so I'm going to talk about today some of those lacking research specific to the South and Mississippi in terms of health care, housing, employment, all of these ways that we're just still lacking resources. But at the same time, these trans men find a way to make a life and be happy in the South. They feel comfortable. One guy said, I would stick out like a sore thumb in my cowboy boots and cowboy hat in New York City. So why would I live there? He described himself as a country dude who likes to sit on the tailgate and drink moonshine out of a mason jar with his hound dog. Like, he would look really weird in the city. So this metro normative narrative is kind of what I'm trying to say. Not all queer people live in New York City and San Francisco. We live everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for us, we say, duh. But other places, that's really mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah. I know. And like that review, like the fact that you would even ask why trans men live in the South
This yeah. makes me shake my head. I'm about to go on an epic rant. I'll try to hold back. But no, it's yeah. that same problem, right?
Yeah. Which,
you know, I was, you know, my book, The Lesbian South, is all mm-hmm. about this tradition of yeah. lesbian feminist organizing that is invisible to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Samantha Allen was here a few weeks ago
uh-huh.
with her book, Real Queer America, LGBT Stories from the Red States.
Uh-huh.
And she was having the same conversation about, you know, how interesting, how supportive these communities are. And when I asked her, she's living in Seattle now, I said,
yeah.
how do you like Seattle? She said, I miss queer Southern community.
Yeah.
And nobody in Seattle would believe that. You know, they'd
yeah.
be like, no,
yeah,
you're
yeah,
in heaven. You're
yeah.
on the West Coast. I grew up on the West Coast, so I understand that
yeah.
moment. But I love queer Southern community, too.
Yeah.
I fell in love with the LGBTQ plus community when I moved here. And
uh-huh.
they are so hilarious and resilient and community-driven and caring that I just am amazed at the way the queer community takes care of people and the way that allies have increasingly stepped in there. So instead of saying, why don't you move elsewhere?
Yeah.
We should say, how can we support you?
Right, exactly. And I do have one chapter about, you know, I call it the discord in the LGBTQ community. So about how the queer community is not always accepting of trans people. But then at the same time, I talk about some of my respondents said, I love being in the South queer community because we all have each other's back because we know no one else does. So in other areas, we can divide along these different letter alphabets. You know, we can divide along these lines, but they're like in my rural community, especially, we don't divide because we're all we have. And so it's a more strong knit community and more supportive
yeah.
in a lot of ways. So I mean, I think there's problems still, but there's that. And I think the resources are just largely lacking. I talk about in my research on drag how a lot of times drag kinging and drag queens are using drag as a resource because of the lack of information and healthcare. And give a shout out to the LGBT Southern Health Survey, national survey that just came out last week.
Yes.
Yeah, and they talk about, I think it was 70% of trans LGBT people in the South had positive experiences with healthcare. So they find a lot of resources lacking and a lot of problems remain, but we're talking about the majority of people now are getting adequate healthcare. It's not all bad. It's not all negative. So I want to point out both of those sides and show we need more resources. We need more education, but we also need to realize people live here because they want to live here. The South is not this one thing
yeah.
that we've all been taught it is, even living here.
I totally agree with that. I mean, one of the things I talk about is how sometimes mainstream gay presses are just enamored of the abject South.
Yeah, yeah.
And they only want to circulate stories. You know, when there was that pride parade in Starkville,
yeah.
there was lots of coverage when the permit was denied, and
yeah.
there was a lot less when
right.
it came
all
through
right.
because that didn't fit the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I totally agree with that. And the more we can have these conversations about the diversity of this community and the ways it, I think, has not broken up into parts in the same way that it does
mm-hmm.
in other spaces is really important. And I also think, you know, the LGBTQ plus community more broadly, I hope, is moving toward more full trans inclusion and some of the crazy, I hate to see some of these eruptions of
mm-hmm.
of transphobia, especially in older lesbian communities
right.
that has
yeah.
been happening. I mean, I don't think it's all of them, but they're really vocal
right.
contingents, and it's so destructive whenever we're turning on each other instead of building those communities together.
Right.
So.
And I think it goes back to what we were talking about, and I kind of end this book on the same note of this empathy and this conversation. I think that these divisions within the queer community and within the South, even the most of the trans men I spoke to said the South is like this because of ignorance, right? Because of whether that's chosen ignorance or just complete lack of not knowing, you don't know. But most of the trans men and myself included, I identify as genderqueer, but under the trans umbrella, trans masculine, all of us hadn't heard the word trans until we were, I mean, the younger people sometimes in middle school and high school, but my people over 30, we didn't hear the word trans until the internet really took off. Like, we were all in high school or out of high school before we heard the word, and before we really even felt like we could think about the word, we were adults. So this idea that we would expect, you know, Southern evangelical Christians just to jump on board, like, sometimes I still mess it up. I use they, them, or she, her, and then and then sometimes I mess up other people's pronouns. So it's like the fact that I can't get it right, and I teach this, I study this, I write this, I do this every day, and I can't get it right. We can't just expect everyone to jump on board. So we need to help educate. And I think empathy and education are my two main
yeah.
things in everything I write, that if we can do those things, maybe we could move forward.
I totally agree. And I feel the same way. You know, I feel like, I mean, I am probably 20 years older than you. And so I find that I am trying to keep up constantly. And yeah. I make mistakes more than I want to.
Yeah, me too.
But when I do, I apologize and I try to do better. Yeah. And I think if we can have that kind of spirit for people to say, you know, you respect people, you use whatever terms they ask you to use, and you respect their dignity fundamentally as people, I think we're all going to do better.
Yeah. And I think that it's hard for people who don't understand, like I was saying, like evangelical Christians or more conservative or older people. But then I think it's also hard for young trans people and young LGBT people in general coming out because it means so much and it personally hurts them so bad. So I think we have this, like, I know when I was younger, like, if someone were to say something to me that was homophobic, it hurt a lot worse than it does now. So I get why people are so offended, and we're so conscious in our classrooms, for example, of trying to make sure everything is just going smoothly and everybody's using the right pronouns always and not leaving enough room for mistakes because it hurts people. But at the same time, if we don't leave room for mistakes, then people just shut down. So it's, again, a balance that I'm not sure how to make or how to balance yet, but we need to all work on.
When we come with goodwill and we're trying to show care, I think we can find that. You know, it's interesting. JD and I had a whole conversation where he asked me to talk about LGBTQ and the different letters, and I talked to him and I said, listen, it's okay to ask.
Yeah.
Right? If you're not sure,
yeah,
ask. And if you make a mistake, correct yourself and move on. You know, I'm like, I do this for a living and I make mistakes all the time.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I'm grateful for the people who keep trying to help me be better. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can do that and recognize that it's about letting people learn and grow, and as long as you're coming at it with, I think, an open heart of trying to be caring and not just trying to troll people or, you know, that I think is a harder attitude to deal with. But if people are really of goodwill, I think you can always figure out a way to talk.
Yeah. And I think, especially after doing some baseline yourself, I would say. So ask, yes, but don't ask about someone's genitalia. You wouldn't ask someone.
No,
I know,
but
you
that's
know
just
that.
Rude.
No,
no matter who you're talking to.
I know,
to.
But I just felt like we need to clarify.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, because like with trans people, a lot of trans people in the South I found are passing as cis and not out as trans, specifically to avoid those conversations. And it's not because they don't want to educate people and have conversations, it's because the questions are inappropriate. So do some baseline education, do some baseline reading, don't ask questions you wouldn't want to answer, but questions like, what are your pronouns, what name do you prefer, those are questions that you would answer. So ask those questions. And,
yes, that's so important. Yes. Thank you for making that clear.
Yeah, no, I mean, I knew what you meant, but I just wanted to be clear.
No, I totally agree. Yeah. What I mean by ask questions is, you know, how would you like me to refer to you?
Right.
What's the appropriate term?
Right.
And then move on.
And what does that term mean to you even? Yeah. Because it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. So I think all of those are great, just not about someone's sex life or
no, because
their,
that's just prurient interest. I mean, that's just turning people into
freak
show objects.
Right.
That's not, that's never appropriate, or whom you're talking to.
I mean,
I can't tell you how many times people make assumptions about, you know, queer people's sex lives and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll say, you know, if you're going to ask about sex lives, you need to answer any question you're asking me. And if you're not comfortable, rethink that question.
It's very uncomfortable when you get those.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to let you do another plug. Please tell us the names of your two forthcoming books. Anyone feeling inadequate now, just deal with it. Tell us about it, Becky.
Okay, so the first one coming out with Rutgers in December is Conditionally Accepted, Christians' Views of Sexuality and Gay and Lesbian Civil Rights. And then with Lexington Books, Trans in the South, Becoming Men comes out in January.
It's so great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're hoping maybe in the future we can bring you back and talk about, we've been doing some symposia on LGBTQ youth in the church, so we'd love to have you come back and talk. Baker Rogers from Georgia Southern University here for the Trans Summit. We're hoping to have him back. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time on Swerve Sound.
Swerve South is a production of the Sarah Isom Center for Women and Gender Studies, with support from the Southern Documentary Project, music and engineering by Tyler Keith.